everybody. Welcome to the Clue-In webinar, electroplating process cleanup and case study. It's part of our OSC Readiness Present series, sponsored by the US EPA. I'm Mike Adams, sitting in for Gene Balin today as your moderator. I'm from the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Information. Before I turn things over to the presenter for today's seminar, there are a few logistics I'd like to go through, and if you're online right now or if you're looking at your PowerPoint presentation, we're on slide 2 for some housekeeping. If you are using a phone line, please mute your phone, but do not put us on hold. If you do not have a mute button, you can use star 6 to mute. For today's presentation, there are two Q&A sessions during the presentation. One of them will be after the process material, and one at the end of today's presentation. The easiest way for participants to ask questions is by using the question mark icon at the top of the HTML presentation. This is the preferred way to ask questions for today's seminar. You do not need to wait until the Q&A session to submit questions via this text form. And if you do use this form, please remember to add the slide number of which your question pertains so that we can direct folks back to it during the Q&A session. You may also use this form to alert us of any technical problems you may be having. The presenter for today's seminar will alert you to which slide we're on. You'll have to manually advance each slide. If you're using the HTML online version, you can navigate the presentation with the arrow buttons at the top of your screen, again, as shown on slide 2. You should have already clicked the Go to Session button at the top of the seminar homepage if you're still getting there. You need to do that now. And after the session, you can access the feedback form in the additional resources links from the sidebar buttons on the seminar homepage. And we've also provided a link to these on the second to last slide of this presentation. We appreciate your feedback, and we ask that you please fill out that form. If you wish to receive a printout receipt of your attendance, you may print a confirmation form that is displayed after you have filled out this feedback form. This event will be recorded and will be archived on the Clue-In website. Within about 2 weeks, you should be able to download it in several formats or replay it online. You may also subscribe to our Clue-In podcast to receive new archived seminars as they become available. You may subscribe to our various feeds by navigating with the buttons on the Staying Connected right-hand sidebar when you're on clue-in.org. And today's presenter is James Mullins. I'll let Jim introduce himself, but suffice to say that he has plenty of experience in this area. More biographical information can be found on the seminar homepage, along with his contact information. You can go back to the seminar homepage, and there's a hyperlink over his name, and then I'll take you to his bio. One more reminder, please mute your phone. If you don't have a mute button, star 6. I'll turn it over to today's speaker. Jim?
Thanks, Mike. Let me give you a quick introduction to myself. I'm Jim Mullins. I work for 25 of my 30 years of federal career for EPA Region 6 in Dallas. 15 of those last 15 years I was teaching courses, training courses such as this, and after I retired in 2008, I applied for and was given a job with Tetra Tech to continue this teaching. So that's probably about all you need to know about me. I need to put the course today or the training today into perspective for you. Metal finishing process, you should be on slide 3 now. Metal finishing process is a pair of modules that we'll cover today, and it's a pair out of about a dozen modules in the industrial process. The philosophy behind the industrial process course that's taught at OSC Readiness is that on-scene coordinators and others who are in the environmental industry and cleanup business need to know and understand a little bit about the process of the industry they're working on to know what they're cleaning up. They need to know where the contaminants are, what they are, where they're likely to be located, and so forth. So that's the spirit in which we offer this. specifically in the metal finishing process. It's a pretty broad topic. We're going to talk about electroplating today, and this training will be divided into two parts. The first part is process-oriented. The second part, we'll have a short break for questions. Then the second part is the case study. And on slide three, you'll see a gentleman raising a basket up or a barrel up. That barrel's full of small parts, and he's moving it from one plating bath to the next. So that's an actual picture of the process we'll study mostly. There are other than barrel method, but the barrel method is the one we're going to use today. And characteristic of this process is lots of different baths, moving the parts from one bath to the next, which is important environmentally, as you'll see. All right, slide four. All of the modules in industrial process have a set of learning objectives. They're listed for you here on slide four. I don't want to read those to you. I'll let you read them yourself. I'll give you a few minutes, a few seconds. We'll cover each one of these topics in more or less detail. They should all be addressed today, though. Slide five. All right. This is a pretty big industry as when you consider it collectively. There are tens of thousands of businesses, and they range in size from large automobile manufacturing to mom-and-pop type job shops. And the pictures at the bottom are intended to show you some of that range. Coordinators typically clean up abandoned facilities under the Superfund program, and barrel method is one that is preferentially abandoned because it's a small business. Slide seven. Again, characteristic of the industrial process module, all of them, all dozen of them, have a slide on key chemicals. These are the kinds of chemicals you should expect to see in the process here in electroplating. And I'm not going to read those to you, but it does involve solvents, and the coatings are mainly metals in this case. We do have cyanide listed there because of its importance to the process and importance to the environmental work, and then some strong acids and bases. Slide eight. This is a picture of a large industry. You see the number 35 in the slide there. That I take to mean the 35th sequential plating bath that's like this. So this is a large industry, or medium, at least a large medium size one. This is in the manufacture of solar panels, and this is a specialty kind of plating where they're plating sequentially copper, indium, gallium, and selenium onto solar panels. And this is by the rack method. If you look in the center of the picture there, you'll see something that looks like a bar in a coat closet with hangers on it. That's the rack, and it's conductive. Another key to this process is you see the fluids in the bath that appear to be moving rapidly. They are. They should be. So those are characteristics of the industry. Okay.
Hey, Jim, we need you to speak up a little bit, if you can.
Okay, can you hear now better?
I can hear you. Just to keep a continuous, steady voice and stay loud.
Is this okay? Can you hear me now, Mike?
I can, yes.
Okay, thanks. Slide nine. This is a standard process schematic we use again in all the modules of the industrial process course. It's intended to convey, in the general sense, the information about this particular process. Let's start in the lower left-hand corner with the R. These are reagents, cyanide, metal salts, solvents, bases, and acids. Raw materials just above that, and that's the unfinished products. On the right-hand side, you have the finished products. These are the plated parts. Byproducts is B, recycled solvents. W is solid waste, metal sludges and scales. At the bottom of the schematic is liquid wastes coming out, which are as expected. And at the top are air emissions. So that's kind of the spectrum of the way the industry works. All right, let's see what's on slide 10. In order to electroplate something, you must first do some surface preparation. Often there's a physical modification that involves use of abrasives or scaling agents. Surface oil removal is important, and usually the processing of these steel parts particularly. There's a lot of cutting oils that are used, and surface oil removal can be by wiping, dipping, or vapor degreasing. We're going to go into vapor degreasing in a little more detail in the next slide or two. And then a final cleaning, which is detergent, some sort of anodic or cathodic cleaning, and or ultrasonic. The one of these that we'll use will be an alkaline detergent. Okay, let's go to slide 11. This is a vapor degreaser. It's a schematic diagram, but it'll start at the bottom of the thing and go up. If your process that you're cleaning up after use this, there's going to be some solvents loose somewhere. And the way it works is there's a pool of boiling solvent at the bottom of the tank. The parts to be cleaned live in the just above the liquid in the where the vapors are heavy from the boiling solvents. And at the top above that is some condensing coils. These are usually refrigeration coils. Can be cooled even by cold water. But in theory, none of the vapors escape that. They're all condensed and fall back down in liquid form into the bottom, and the cycle repeats itself. Very efficient way to clean. It's not perfect, and it's not foolproof as far as leaks to the environment. Slide 12 will show you some of the solvents that were most commonly used in this process. And this process is generally, I think, environmentally unfriendly, and it's largely abandoned now. But what you see there is the organochlorine heavies that you've chased on other sites or wills, particularly the bottom one. Perchloroethylene is a solvent that's used in dry cleaning, too. So this is fairly typical of the solvents used in that process we just talked about. And if that was used in your facility where you're cleaning up, you're going to be chasing some of these things. We'll talk about the locations later. We're going to skip slide 13. Go to 14. There are some... please, somebody's got their phone off mute. Check that if you will. There are some conditions that are used for painting or coating. And as the slide says, chromates, phosphates, phosphoric acid, hexavalent chromium may be used for this. Again, environmentally important if they escape the process. Probably one of the most common examples of this conversion coating is anodizing. Most people are familiar with anodized aluminum in the habit, anodized aluminum screens or storm windows on their house. And so that's kind of an example of this surface coating. Let's go to slide 15. That's talking a little more about anodizing. It is an electrochemical process. And the value it imparts is to change the metal on the surface to an insoluble oxide.
just about everybody's familiar with an old county courthouse that has a copper roof. The roof is turned green. The green is a copper oxide that prevents the roof from further deterioration. The oxide actually protects the underlying metals. And you see at the bottom a picture of a chromic acid anodizing vat. Chromic acid may use some hexavalent chromium, and if you have this on a job site, what you're going to find is that environmentally it creates some problems for you, very often in contamination of soil and groundwater. Let's go to slide 16. Now, this is some details on the electroplating process itself. It's electrochemical, so it employs DC current as well as a variety of chemicals. It's done at a variety of pHs, on the acid side, which is below 7, on the alkaline side, which is above 7, or at a near-neutral pH, which is 7. And metal salts goes without saying. These are usually the salts that you're replacing zinc or chromium or some other metal, cadmium. Cyanides are going to be a carrier ion that keeps the metal ions in solution. Brighteners, things that improve the reflection or shiny characteristics. These picture at the bottom is some fiber drums that were taken from an abandoned plating shop. And this is zinc cyanide. Now, the significance of this to the person who's doing the cleanup is pretty substantial. It's a powder, and it's concentrated cyanide. So one of the things you're going to wind up having to do is make sure you don't get this in touch with any acids, because if you do, you'll generate some cyanide gas and a whole variety of downstream problems from that. So zinc, it's not atypical to find cyanide concentrates like this on job sites where you're cleaning up plating shops. Slide 17 is important. This is intended to be the process. Originally this was animated, and it added a little bit. We can't give you animation in this format today. But this is a block diagram showing how the process works for electroplating. It starts in the upper left and goes to the lower right, as the arrows indicate. And the top line is about how to prepare the surface, and the bottom line is about treating the surface or plating out. Starts with an alkaline cleaner. If you think of an easy-off oven cleaner, this is what this is similar to. It's a very strong alkaline material that's used to cut the oil and grease. The next block shows is a rinse bath. And it's important that you, when you pull that basket out of the alkaline cleaner and put it into the rinse, that you understand there's some drag out. Some of the solution sticks from the alkaline cleaner that has to be taken off in the rinse bath. Now, anytime you see one of these blocks with rinse on it, and there's four of them here, usually you're talking about a series of tanks, not just one tank, but there's usually two or three in a series. So it'll be alkaline cleaner, rinse, 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 acid dip, so forth, rinse, 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 then into the plating bath. And the multiple rinses are important to remove the material of the previous bath so that it doesn't interfere with the next bath. A drag out tank is what it sounds like. You pull the basket out of the plating bath and suspend it over the drag-out tanks, excuse me, and let it drip. So you minimize the amount that's going to have to come off in the rinse. Now, with these rinse baths being common and being frequent and multiples, one of the things you're going to generate here is a large volume of low concentration rinse water. That's important as we go through this, because many of these, in order to deal with a large volume of wastewater, use city sanitary sewers. That sometimes gets them into problems. Alright, let's go to the next one, which is a photograph of this is slide 18. photograph of a plating shop abandoned. This will not win the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval. This is not atypical. You'll notice one thing in common on a lot of these actual photographs. They're pretty dark and dreary. That's because the utilities have been cut off. And they may not have been that good. But what you see is a series of these square tanks where the basket was dipped in there and set down for a while and then moved to the next bath. All right, let's go to slide 19. Kind of more of the same. What you see in the upper part of that is a circular pipe, and I don't know if you're familiar with the electric hoist. On the right-hand upper quadrant, you see a hoist motor. That's used to move the basket from bath to bath to bath, but this will not win the Underwriters Laboratory's seal of approval for wiring. Another thing that's common here, remember we talked about the use of caustics. Caustics are very, very slick, and so slip, trip, and fall hazards are pretty terrible in these places. And we have acids and strong bases, which are directly incompatible chemicals, and mixing them can generate a lot of heat, perhaps a steam explosion or even a fire. Let's go to slide 20. The bench in the foreground is the quality control laboratory for this plating operation. And I don't say that tongue-in-cheek. That's it. That's all there was. This is a very small business. That's the main point I want to make there. 21. This is another plating shop, and this one happens to be a little better organized than some of the others. I would probably characterize this one as a medium-sized business. They were particularly neat, I thought, because they're just well organized, but it is abandoned. These are pictures taken by an on-scene coordinator or cleanup contractor. You see the individual baths. The next shot, I think, is the same shop. But you notice on the walls they have stenciled what the various vats are, which, again, is pretty unusual. That's well done as these things go. Notice the elevated walkway between the baths. That is there for convenience of the workers. There's a lot of bending over and stooping. This helps in that regard. It also helps to keep the slick. It's wooden usually, and the wood does not deteriorate terribly badly under the attack of caustics. It's a little more forgiving as far as slip, trip, and fall, too. Okay, let's go to slide 22. This is that same plating shop, and there's the elevated walkway. You're looking down the other direction. And in this one, the utilities are on. We see the lights on in the distance. And again, this is probably on the good end of organization. The other slides you saw were more toward the bad end of good housekeeping. Multiple baths. Let's go to slide 23. This is had a few animations on it in the original presentation. Let's start in the upper left-hand corner. This is electroplating, so we have an electrical source, and it is DC, direct current. So you either have a DC generator or AC with a rectifier. And coming out of that, you have an anode and a cathode. And on the center of this is the plating bath. The anode has, it's called sacrificial anodes. These are the metals that you're going to plate. And they migrate from the anode to the cathode. The parts you're going to plate are attached to the cathode, and so there's an attraction. And the work pieces get plated electrically. The cyanide stays in solution, and in a perfect world, you don't have to add any more, but drag out and other phenomenon result in more or less a continuous addition of cyanide as a carrier ion. All right, let's go to the next slide, which is 24. This is a plating vat for chrome plating. notice on the left-hand side of the vat, there's some colored spatter. This is splash of the plating material. I believe the root word for chrome is Greek or Latin for color, chromos. And depending on the valence state of the chrome that you're using, it can be one of several colors. It's not all shiny. It can be green or black or yellow or red. So I guess that's where Kodachrome comes from. Kodak's clever again. Anyway, next slide is 25. And we're going to look at some common electroplating bath compositions. If you are tasked with cleaning up an electroplating shop that's been abandoned, it's very handy for you to know what was being plated and what the composition of the plating bath was. So if you look at that first one, brass and bronze, and the composition is copper cyanide, zinc cyanide, sodium carbonate, ammonia, and Rochelle salt. Now, I'm not sure what Rochelle salt imparts to the process, but it's important to that process and is commonly used. And I would invite you to read those others, particularly calcium fluoroborate, the next to the bottom bath. If you look through there, you see anything a little strange on the composition side? Yeah, licorice. Licorice, as it turns out, is an additive that is a brightener. It helps with brighten the resulting electroplating of cadmium.
0.1 mile. Take a left. Head east 12th Street.
All right, somebody's got their phone not muted. We're getting a GPS unit, so mute if you can. The last entry on that slide 25 is zinc. And zinc plating is probably the most common electroplating process in use in the country today. It's known as galvanizing in many circles. It's distinctly different than hot dip galvanizing, which is what it sounds like, where you heat the zinc metal up and dip the part that we put plated in there, and it, the zinc cools on there. This is an electroplating coating that's very much thinner and very much cheaper. So zinc electroplating is the most common. It is unusual if you do five plating cleanups in your career to not have one or two of them be zinc. All right, let's go to the next slide. 26, air emissions. I think you might remember from the schematic that we had some solvent vapors, and it goes without saying, probably had some acid mist too. Water releases. We talked about the high volume, low concentration rinse water. That's a big deal. It's a big significant environmentally, because there's a lot of water to handle. The plating baths do not last indefinitely, so sometimes they're spent and must be dealt with. And then just general washdown liquids is another release possibility from housekeeping. All right, let's go to 27. More modes of release. If you look at the diagram, schematic diagram in the lower right-hand corner of this slide, what you see is pretty typical conceptual site model of how some release or spill affects the groundwater. And before it has affected the groundwater, it's affected the soil above the groundwater. And gravity pulls it right on down into the contamination plume. So washdown liquids and solvents can impact the soil. And the heavy metals like hexavalent chromium and chlorinated solvents, which are DNAPLs, certainly can affect that. Anytime you've got one of those vapor degreasing units, you're probably going to have some of this to chase. Pardon me. All right, let's go to slide 28. These are the solid waste, the metals, T-clip metals, leaching procedure. These are characteristic metals. Wastewater, spent plating bass, quenching bass. All these have RCRA numbers associated with it, numbers associated with these waste streams. Let's go to 29. Now, one of the messages on this slide is make a chemist your friend. I'm not a real good chemist. I'm kind of a terrible chemist, as a matter of fact. But if you are if you're analyzing for metals, atomic absorption, or AA, with inductive recoupled plasma is a good choice. Solvents is either GC or GCMS, or perhaps mass spec. There are some field analytical methods. HAZCAD is a great tool and gets you a long ways along on this jobs. X-ray fluorescence is another good field analytical method. It's also a good laboratory method. For cyanide, you have real-time instruments. Draeger is an old standby colorimetric indication. And on the right, lower right-hand corner, you have a picture. I believe that's one of the Ray instruments, area Ray instruments, that can be set up for cyanide gas. Make a chemist your friend. All right, let's see. Slide 30. Okay, here we're going to sum this up a little bit. So the plating industry is characterized by mostly small businesses, and these are, since they're not large businesses, they do not have a lot of resources to devote to environmental control programs, and so as a result, they're usually pretty sloppy, sometimes terribly sloppy. There's a pretty broad brush variety of chemicals, including solvents and metals and cyanides, and corrosives, and that corrosives is intended to cover acids and bases. All of the environmental media can be impacted by metal finishing or electroplating, and generally are. Okay, now let's see. I believe that wraps up the process discussion. Mike, do we have any questions? Are you there, Mike?
Yes, we do. Yeah. Sorry about that. I had my phone on mute. I'd like to apologize to everybody. We did have some audio issues early on, and I hope those have at least in part been corrected. We certainly tried. Okay, but we had a we have a question starting back on slide 7, I believe, and the question is, what is the benzene used for?
Let me look back here. I'm backing up to slide 7. Forgive me if I can give up. Vapor degreasing. It could be used in wiping parts with to remove gross physical contaminants. These are key chemicals as identified by a number of years of ATSDR studying the chemicals that were identified on electroplating shops. It could be potentially a component of BTEX, a fuel BTEX, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, xylene, for running forklifts and that sort of thing. But ATSDR identified this list, and they did it based on what had been identified by various field units cleaning up these sites. I hope that answers your question.
And we also had question. In remediating a chrome plating facility, we ran across concrete with its underside stained with a purple color that appeared to be potassium permanganate. Is permanganate used in conjunction with chrome plating to maintain a chromium oxidation state?
Okay. Ask that question one more time. Is potassium permanganate used for...
Is potassium permanganate used in conjunction with chrome plating to maintain the chrome 6 oxidation state?
It could be. You know, you heard me say, Mike, a chemistry friend. I'm not a chemist. I don't claim to be, and I don't know the answer to this question. That's the most direct answer I can give you. I know potassium permanganate is an oxidizer, and you have to treat it as a waste stream that not to be mixed with things that should not be oxidized, organics and so forth, or you have fires. I do not know the purpose of it in a chrome plating operation, but I would encourage the person who has this to speak to a chemist. I can do that too. If you want me to, I can try to chase that down. If you want me to chase it down, please give a follow up in the Q&A format you just used. Okay, Michael, you got another one?
Now that's all I've got here, but I want to go ahead just in case there's somebody that does have a question on the phone line. They can hit pound 6 to unmute their phone or unmute their phone and go ahead and ask the question now. Wanted to make sure everybody could participate just in case they weren't logged in. And
excuse me, what did you say the Rochelle fault was?
I don't know what the Rochelle fault is. I can look it up. My point in this was this is on slide 25, if I recall. There are a number of unusual, perhaps even bizarre kinds of materials found in the composition of various plating baths. Rochelle salt is one, and that's a common name from the 1950s, I believe. I don't know the exact makeup of Rochelle salt, but I can find out and email you if you'll give me an address on that. And licorice was just the kind that you eat as a candy or a confection was in the cadmium fluoroborate plating bath. My sense of it is that these composition of these plating baths is squarely between science and chemistry and witchcraft. Licorice, for example, as a brightening agent, how did they discover that?
Yeah. Snack time.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay, we got any more?
I don't have any questions, but I do have some folks that chimed in, and I can give you I can forward some of the information on the previous questions that we weren't able to answer so that we can get back to those folks. Someone thought that chromic acid flake is purple in color and may have created the purplish color noted in the question example that I talked about earlier, and then someone also had hypothesized that maybe the potassium permanganate could have been used to clean organic materials from the metal that was to be plated. That's sort of a pretreatment. And then I do have a question that did just come in. And what is the typical physical state of these chemicals, with the example being chrome 6, when they're used as raw material? Are they liquid, solid? When you enter the facility, what state are these in, or the raw materials in?
It's all over the map. It depends on, if you give me a specific example, I can try to get you some specific answers. The zinc cyanide, for example, that was used as a source of zinc as well as a carrier ion cyanide, that comes in a powder. And it's a kind of a tan-colored powder that at room temperature and pressure, and you buy it on the open market just that way. It's expensive. They put it in a fiber drum, or they did it originally. I'm not sure why, because that's subject to getting moist and degrading rapidly. But the chrome compounds, there's a variety of those that are used based on which plating bath or which plating solution is being applied. And let me turn that phone off. Excuse me. The specific physical state of these is dependent on what you're buying or what you're trying to accomplish and which particular chemical you've selected. Sodium cyanide is another common carrier ion. It comes in a 30-pound fiber drum, and it's a white powder. So it could be a variety of things. Give me a specific chemical, and I'll try to give you some specific answers. You can do that through the regular submission process of the question and answers. Okay, Mike, what's next?
The only example that he mentioned here was chrome 6.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it, I do have someone here commented that Rochelle salt is potassium sodium tartrate.
Sounds right to me. I haven't looked it up. I would do a Google search of it, and that's probably what you.
Yep. We had a couple people actually chime in on that one, yeah.
Say it again, Mike. Potassium.
Sodium tartrate.
Okay. I don't know Rochelle salt, but that sounds fine.
Yeah, we had a couple people chime in and said that's what it is. I did have another question that came in, and it is it reasonable to expect that a vapor degreaser or some type of degreasing operations occur with most any plating operation?
I think it's reasonable to expect that some type of degreasing operation or de-oiling operation occurs. And here's kind of the way that plays out. If it's steel, which is the most commonly plated raw material, when steel is in the manufacturing process, it's stamped or machined in some way to the part that's being plated. That machining and handling involves cutting oils. It keeps the machines that do the forming cool, and it keeps the metal from getting brittle. And so what you have is you have whatever the manufacturing process was usually involves some oil or grease. And you cannot plate on top of oil and grease, electroplate on top of oil and grease. You have to remove it. Now, is it reasonable to expect that that's all vapor degreasing? I don't think that's probably a safe assumption because there are so many ways to get the grease off. For example, you could have a rag wet with benzene, wipe it 4 or 5 times. You may accomplish the same objective. You could tumble it in sand for an hour, accomplish the same objective. You could use vapor degreasing. They're just a process selection is inherent to the particular process and industry. I think one of the things that's kind of gnaws at is for the people who are doing the cleanup to talk to those who were involved in the industry and say, how did you do this? Tell me how this worked. Tell me about your process. Tell me what kind of raw materials you ordered. Tell me what kind of reagents you ordered. And that'll help you solve the process dilemma you're chasing right now. I hope that's a reasonable answer.
I've got a question.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm just interested as to the reference of hexavalent chromium. And as to whether or not trivalent chromium may also be expected to be used in the plating operations, is it primarily the hexavalent chromium that is used?
I am not enough of a chemist to give you a final answer on that, or I can hum a few bars of a song that a chemist sang to me one time, or crudely speaking. Nature does not like hexavalent chromium, and nature will do everything it can to change hexavalent chromium to one of the other valence states, and there are several. So hexavalent chromium will not persist or it's not, it tends not to persist in the environment. It is, hexavalent chromium is useful for certain applications in industry, and I don't know if hex chrome or trichrome is the preferred state, but I know that you run into a lot of hex chrome in the plating industry. Again, I apologize for not being enough of an expert about this, but this may be a case where you make a chemist your friend.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, I think we should go into the case study.
Yeah, go ahead and do that. I didn't have any come in anymore. I mean, if there are any remaining questions, we can get to those at the end of the case study. If you're on the phone line, please mute your phone now.
And I want to thank you for the questions you've asked there. This is a good group. You've engaged, and you're asking great questions. I apologize for not being enough of an expert to answer all of them. But if you'll put them in writing, I'll make sure you get an answer eventually. Go to slide 31. We're going to do a composite. And a composite case study is kind of interesting in that these are real EPA cleanups from epaosc.org, and the address is right there for you. So let's go to 32. And a traditional case study, you get one example and you learn. A composite case study, you learn by citing many examples. And what we did was, at the urging of the OSC who put this, had the responsibility for putting this class together, was we went to osc.org, www.epaosc.org, and did a survey for about 4 or 5 years and found that there were plating shops cleaned up in that 4 or 5 year span in just about every region. Some had many plating shop cleanups, particularly those where the auto industry had a downturn. There was a lot of abandonment. And then we interviewed the OSCs who were responsible for the job. So there was a total of 13 of these sites we looked at. We were able to reach 12 of the OSCs. And we had some lessons learned. We have advice from OSC. We have some tricks of the trade and some cautions. So that's kind of the nature of this composite case study. And this has generated a lot of interest to this approach. And be interested to hear when you do your evaluation what your opinion is about it. On slide 33, you see the key to this. There's a link address that has four X's at the end of it on the first bullet. If you substitute those four X's with the two or to four digit alphanumeric that you'll see on these slides, you'll get back to the original source material that we use for this presentation. And some examples are 4771, 1981, UG, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, 1981 is an example we'll use, and you see that on the last line. And in case you want to go back to that, if you advance to slide 34, I'm having technical difficulty here. Let's see if I can go to 34. You advance to slide 34, you'll bring up the R.N. Hitchcock electroplating facility. It's in Port Byron, New York, which is Region 2. And you'll see these IDs like 1981 on all the slides, or on many of the slides, not necessarily all of them. Okay. Let's see here. Now, let's go to 35. These are topics that we broke the results of the interviews and the photos down. Safety, basics, neighborhood issues, management tools, fires and contingency plans, utilities, soil cleanup, T&D promptness, totes, recycling, scrap, and trash. So there's a variety of stuff that came out of here, and really what you're going to be getting is advice from OSCs who've done these cleanups, and so I think you'll find some of this very interesting. Let's advance to, let's see here, My system's moving really slow now, forgive me. All right, let's go back to 36. All right. On slide 36, this is about safety. No. This is about the best advice from OSC's overall advice. Safety was in every topic. Electroplating, because of its use of cyanide and the high disaster potential, it was in every single topic, every advice, every OSC's advice. The medical community has an expression called watch one, do one, teach one. That's a surgeon's maxim. And so it's important, the OSCs felt like, for you to seek the advice of an OSC who'd done one of these or several of these before you launch into it, because there's always something you can learn from sitting down and talking to somebody who just did one. Legally sufficient access. That sounds very trite and trivial, but this is a constitutional law issue. And if you want to make your attorney really nervous, do something that affects constitutional law. So legally sufficient access, make sure you got it taken care of. Very elementary, good site sketch, but it's very, very important. So start off. The best advice is begin with a good ending in mind. Start with a good site sketch. Engaging the locals early and often. We're going to talk about some advantages of that. You're likely to get some of the operational history. For example, from the fire department saying, man, we went out there 10 times in a 4-month period and so forth. And I think the quality of the support staff was another key item that came out of the interviews. You want to make sure you use contractors that have plating shop experience, and in the vein of make a chemist your friend, you really need an on-site chemist for cleanup of a plating shop for hazcatting, bulking, and incompatibles. Those are key issues on a plating shop. All right, let's see, slide 37. The number one, without question, issue was public health and safety, workforce safety. We talked to 12 out of the 13 OSCs, and every one of them, this was the first words out of their mouth, cyanide. High disaster potential, the lethal dose to 50% of the population is very low. It's somewhere around 6 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. Any exposure method will get you with cyanide. Has to be considered in every single activity. And you got to make sure that you reinforce this every day in your daily meetings. Has to be air monitoring as a result of the cyanide. Plating solutions with a high pH. If you decrease the pH over to the acid side, that is below 7, and then there's cyanide present, what you do is you drive the equilibrium so that you generate hydrogen cyanide gas. Bad plan. So make sure you keep your pHs high. And then there's usually some concentrates. We saw some zinc cyanide in a fiber drum. Very dangerous stuff, particularly as far as incompatibility with acids. All right, let's see. 38. This addresses the cyanide issue. And in answer to one of the questions that was posed earlier about physical states and what you might be getting, silver cyanide, copper cyanide, sodium cyanide, potassium cyanide, these are all kinds of cyanide salts that you might find in drums or bulk containers on a cleanup of one of these sites. Keep the pH high as discussed, and do not get the acids and the cyanide-bearing materials together, or bad things will happen. See the 1981 up there? That refers to that site in New York that we looked at earlier. And these are materials that came off of that, cyanide-bearing materials. All right, let's see, 39. My system is really moving slow. I'm going to have to back up, excuse me. right, I have an incomplete slide on 39. This is pumping cyanide solution in a residential setting. You will recall from earlier discussion of the process how we indicated that there were small businesses. This business was run out of a garage in the back of a residential area. The gray building on the right is either an apartment or a single-family dwelling. And you can see from the crowding of the residential setting that managing the cyanide-bearing plating solutions in this situation is really risky. Plating solutions are being pumped into plastic totes. Totes are a commonly used container in a lot of cleanups. We'll address totes a little bit later. All right, let's go to 40. All right, this addresses the idea of air monitoring inside and outside. This is necessitated again by the cyanide. In the lower right-hand picture, you see fence line monitoring, which, of course, is important to be able to document. Here's what left the site, as far as we can tell. We had instrumentation to catch these various things, especially cyanide. In the upper left, you see an area array device deployed inside the building. This is a health and safety type monitor. If you get high enough cyanide readings, you need to change your safety protocols, perhaps change your level of protection, perhaps ventilate the building, perhaps look for the source, and if you've gotten acids with cyanide-bearing materials, change the pH. That's an engineering control. In the upper right is an air monitoring device with an area array under it. I do not know the air monitoring device. We usually ask the audience if they know what this is. So anybody that knows what that device is in the upper right, please submit it in the form of your question. Let's move to 41, is it? Yeah. All right. Thermal stress. This is number two health and safety issue, cyanide being number one. We're going to have both ends of the spectrum. This is a picture of a job site in the Phoenix, Arizona area, and the OSC running the job said 115 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's actual temperature, not misery index, not temperature or humidity index, was our biggest problem. We tried working different shifts, including 4 a.m. to 11 a.m. to escape the heat. Tried nights, and I learned that NG means no good. The example was given, try getting the backhoe fixed at 1:30 a.m. There's always some day work, and somebody gets stuck with it. One of the things to do to eliminate the heat thermal stress in this case is to increase the work rest time to 1:1, sometimes even greater than that. So the rest time might even exceed the work time. Vital signs monitoring, including weight and close observation of the people for heat stress. And rehydration was a constant battle. I'm sure some of you have thought that. At the opposite extreme, we have in the next slide, which is 42, cold. This is, OSC said, minus 20F. Think about that a little bit. It was a huge problem. Some days we just went home, had short work period, and then warm and rest. So instead of having rest periods to cool off, you're having rest periods to warm up. Wind chill was a huge factor. Again, careful monitoring, observing of the workers, looking for things like blue lips and shaky hands and so forth. This particular OSC told us that coffee not only dehydrates you and gives you the jitters, it is a diuretic. Tea is too. And there's some inefficiency associated with having the workforce always run to the potty. In addition to that, you have some issues with heavy clothing and gloves to affect your dexterity. And the last one's one you don't often think about, but the plating shops sometimes corrode the metal parts of the building, which is the roof and the walls. Very often, it's not in this picture, but in some, many industrial settings it is. And if it rains or snows during the day or night, certainly it will freeze at night when the temperatures are traditionally the lowest. And then you wind up with black ice on the slab and forklifts and other vehicles don't get traction, and people find the gravity is sufficient to put them on their fanny a whole lot. So slip, trip, and fall hazards increase dramatically. All right, let's go to the next slide, which is 43. This is about neighborhood settings, and what you see in the upper picture and the lower picture is light industrial and commercial, and then something that looks like out of a painting where you'd want to take your family for a portrait, for a picnic in the summer. So there's high variability in terms of the neighborhood settings, and there's some traffic hazards. That we had one OSC tell us that his greatest fear of an accident on site was one of his workers being hit by a car in the high-speed traffic pattern that was located near the site. Another one was talking about the local crime rate happened to be elevated where he was. In fact, there was evidence inside the building that it had been used as a shooting gallery. In this case, he meant intravenous drug use, and the paraphernalia was left around. And there are things where the OSC training in a formal sense does not give you cover. Where it's really important to get advice from an experienced OSC who's done this, they can help you some with these things. Let's move to slide 44. All right. This is a quote at the top from an OSC in Region 5, and Region 5 was one of those regions that happened to be centered in the automobile industry and during some years when there was a huge downturn in that industry, and a lot of plating shops went belly up, and so this particular guy was Steve Reniger, and he told us we could use his name. If you're interested, you know how to get in touch with him. He's in the OSC directory. But he developed a spreadsheet that helps manage waste streams, and it's a standardized format, and it's a tool to manage with. It does display some critical paths and next steps, and he uses it as a framework for his daily meetings. Today we're going to do this because our spreadsheet shows us this and such, and we're going to go into a little bit of detail on this, but all the waste streams are processed in parallel, and it allows you to do schedule evaluation and rate limiting steps. So if you've got an interest, you may want to call or talk to Steve. Let's go to the next slide, which is 45, I believe. Yeah, 45. Now this is a copy of his table, his summary table. And what I'll tell you is that the first five columns on here are related to identification of the waste stream. There's a name in column one, a container in two, a total volume in three, a physical state in four, a container type in five. And those were things that were very important to identifying the waste stream. So if you look down the rows, you'll have caustic solids, plating sludge, basic chrome liquid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the other columns, take a minute and look at those. The next two columns, sample date and sample results, define milestones in the process. Sample date is what it sounds like. It's the date the sample was taken. And I guess I need to back up just a little bit. This table fills in from left to right. And when you get these various waste streams identified, you can look at this chart, and if some of these rows are not very well populated, or not very far populated to the right, those waste streams are behind in the process. The objective would be to use this so that every row finishes the page on the right-hand column, the last column, the same hour of the same day. That's not usually possible, but that's the objective. So you can use this in the daily work order meeting and say, you know, it looks like to me waste stream 3, our plating sludge, is lagging behind the others. Let's focus on that for today and do this and this and this in order to catch up. So you got a sample date. This is to identify the disposal results. And the next column is the disposal results. And that when you start filling in that column, that means you've gotten the results back. That's a milestone. These are the results that are critical to the disposal of the material. There are other things that come with it, but these are the things that control where it can go and how it must be disposed of. It must be incinerated, maybe landfilled, maybe recycled, et cetera, et cetera. So sample date is a milestone, and you notice you've got these all grouped pretty close together in July. And then disposal sample results are speak for themselves. The next column, color code, is kind of interesting. Steve worked on so many of these. He would segregate his waste streams so that all the caustic solids, row one, were together, physically located together. And then he would paint a marking on there so that if you look down to the third row, yellow star, all of the yellow stars were together. Now, Steve used to say that you don't have to be real smart to work on one of my plating shops, but you can't be colorblind. And the idea here is if it comes the right day to load all the yellow star material onto these trucks, that's the way it works. All right, the next is the profile date. And that is a disposal profile is what it sounds like. It's a profile of results that control where the stuff will go, and that's a milestone too, because when you get the profile together, you're ready to dispose of it. And the approval column is a facility has said we'll take it, and transportation date speaks for itself, disposal date and cost, all of those are fine. Now, this is a wonderful tool for management of a plating shop, so I'd suggest you use this if you got any questions, you can call or check in on this later. Let's go to the next slide. All right, utilities disconnected. We talked about poor lighting and utilities being disconnected. Very common characteristic. This is from site 4771. I don't remember where that one is. But you notice they have temporary lights strung up here. The most common accident on hazardous waste sites, cleanups, is slip, trip, and fall. And part of that is imparted by low visibility from this sort of situation here. Now, you have a choice of, we have another slide talking about utilities disconnected, and we'll cover that in a minute. Let's go to the next slide, which is 47, electrical equipment. This shows a fairly orderly organization for a plating shop. In the right-hand side of the background of the picture, you see what looks to be a generator. It's a DC generator, and that's not very common, but it does happen. You've got to have DC power. One of the things to remember about electrical equipment is you can't see, hear, or smell electricity coming, and it'll get you. So always test. Make sure you de-energize, and some of these things have feeds from several directions. An unusual but unusual reality that you have to deal with is copper theft. At the time this was being put together, the copper was more than $3 a pound for scrap value. PCBs. Anytime you've got electrical equipment, you may have PCBs as dielectric fluids. So there you go. Let's go to 48. All right. What are the circumstances for disconnection in utilities? Remember we talked about large volume but low concentration wastewater? Well, that goes into sanitary sewers or city sanitary sewers. And a lot of times what happens is because some cyanide slips through the process and poisons the activated sludge sanitary sewer for the city, they trace it back and eventually catch these guys who were dumping stuff they shouldn't have been and disconnect the sewer. That word gets to the electric utility, and the electric utility may decide, particularly if the bill hadn't been paid regularly, to disconnect the electrical utilities. Where this leaves you is a little bit of a quandary. Do you want to reestablish the existing service or use generators? Reestablishing the existing service is done with temporary service meters and portable on-site generators you bring in yourself, and each of these options has pluses and minuses and schedule issues and so forth. Let's go to slide 49. Here you see in the upper left-hand corner city sewer connection, and this one has been actually disconnected. This is in the basement of a building, plating shop. It's not uncommon to see floor drains, which are troughs in the concrete. And here you see on the lower right a series of rinse vats that generated lots of wastewater volume that required these troughs and city sewers. All right, let's go to 50. This is an interesting case in Arkansas. There was a fire at a plating shop that happened after the assessment phase but before the removal could occur. This is a case in Region 6 where the OSC was ready to go, but the region could not get the money necessary to clean up, so they had to put off the cleanup. One of the things the OSC did was work with the fire department locally and say, you know, we're going to be delayed. I'm going to get the money. I just don't know when I'm going to get the money. And there'll be several weeks to several months of delay here. So if there just coincidentally happens to be a fire, do not put water on the fire. Let's go to slide 51. This is a picture of the OSC standing on the temporary dam holding back the firefighting water that was put on the fire when it did occur. Firefighters do want to put a lot of the wet stuff on the hot, smoky part. It's hard to keep it from happening. And then in this case, there was all sorts of downstream issues, literally and figuratively. Fish kills, a lot of metal contamination of local creeks and so forth. So saying not to put the fire out with water is a good thing, but it's sometimes hard to accomplish. Let's go to the next slide, which is 52. This is probably a best practice out of Region 5. They put together a short contingency plan for the fire department and the emergency officials. And by short, I mean 1 to 3 pages. And it identifies the key EPA contacts and maybe the key contractor contracts. And it has precautions in there about the job site. Usually the OSCs come to town and do an assessment. They process paper and get the administrative work done to do a cleanup. And when it's clear there's going to be a cleanup and it's not ready to start right away, or even if it is ready to start right away, they make this contingency plan up. And they stop by and meet the fire chief. This kind of peacetime meeting, this is a routine meeting, it generates a great deal of goodwill. You take the fire chief and you say, look, let's go out here and look at the site and I'll tell you what we're going to do and how this works and how to get in touch with me and so forth. And they make several copies of the 1 to 3 page contingency plan, and they give it to the dispatcher, and they put it in the break areas for the fire and the police. And the officers will read it while they're on break. I think this is probably a best practice from Region 5. It should be considered for national adoption, but I'm a contractor, so I don't make those kinds of suggestions. Okay, let's go to slide 53. Recycling and trash. this is a place where you really need to talk to somebody who's experienced and does some of this. The first issue that's going to make your attorney real edgy is the idea of takings. I won't go into a lot of definition about that, but takings is a huge issue, and it's one for which the EPA can be dunned and sued. Generally, the owner will maintain that I want this material, and I'll come get it later. Very often, later is not well specified. Could be 1 day, 1 week, 1 month, 1 year. So if you get that answer, you need to nail that down as to what the recycling and issue is for the trash. Many times, things that are trash are claimed to be product, and it's hard to imagine. We'll see some pictures in a minute of this. If you are recycling, there's always a question of, is this stuff clean enough to recycle? And there are some high-value recyclable metals, as well as some steel, and these can be sold in such a way that the job is credited through your ERS contractor. One thing everybody needs to understand is that the CERCLA fund is only about cleaning up hazardous substances. That's the way the statute is written, hazardous substances. There's nowhere in there where you say managing trash. If it becomes necessary to manage some trash, you can do so if you can justify it to accomplish a safe and timely access for the removal of the hazardous substances. And most of the time that will work well. Don't abuse the privilege, but that's a very good and eloquent approach to this. Let's look at the next slide, which is 54. I believe this is site UG, which I don't remember where this one is. But as you look at this picture, you would conclude certainly a lot of trash there. That is not product. I don't care what the owner says. That is not does not belong to a customer that has any care about it in any event. And if that door, that portal there, was your main entrance and exit to the building, you'd want to clean up some or perhaps all of this in order to have safe and timely removal of the hazardous waste, hazardous substances. That's a case where that's a perfect explanation. And this stuff can go to non-haz landfill, or most of it can. You have to look at it as you go. Let's go to the next slide, which is 55. Here we see a guy on the upper left cleaning up some scrap for recycling. And one of the things to notice about this is he's using a pressure washer and he's knocking something off of the piece that's being held by the worker in the right-hand side of that picture. This generates a waste stream. And it's usually the cleaned-up material is loaded into the bulk box, as you see in the lower right, and transported off-site. Is this a profitable enterprise? Depends on the metal. Usually not very much for steel. It's measured in a few dollars per ton, or generally so. That price is all over the market, and it's just what the market will bear. Let's go to 57. This is from site 1981, and these are cadmium anodes. In the left-hand picture, what you see is a plating bath, and it looks like some springs suspended from a copper bar. Those are not springs, but they are baskets made out of metal, and those balls, cadmium balls on the right upper right-hand side are dropped inside the springs or by the baskets, and this is the sacrificial anode where the metal forms the source of the metal and goes to the plated part. These cadmium balls are very expensive, and so they have a high recycle value. Make sure your crew does not throw these away. And it could, the same sort of thing, the balls could be made out of zinc or other metals too, but that's a very typical organization. All right, let's go to the next slide, which is 57. This is a picture of some drums with a temporary safety fence around them that are staged for off-site transportation and disposal. And I understand this picture was taken just after the truck delivered them to this location, and just before the secondary containment berm was pushed up around the outside of the drum. So that's coming. If that's criticism, give it a few minutes after this picture and you'd have it already. The key to this is that this is on some public land near the county landfill, and because the OSC on Site 4106 did his homework and met early and often with the local officials in the state, they had a friendly relationship, and he was working on a Site 4106 where it was very congested. There was no room to stage drums like he's doing here. And because he brought this problem to the attention of the locals, he said, "Hey, you guys got any place I can put this?" "Well, yes, there's this land here." I dare say if he had not done a good job with his relationship with his county and local folks, he would not have gotten volunteer use of this property. So that's a great example of how there's good payback in order to coordinate carefully and closely and often and frequently with the local officials. Let's go to 58. These are some removal of waste promptly, and we're going to get a quote from an OSC in Region 5 about this. It's pretty staggering to me. Bulk waste on the left, drum waste on the right. Let's go to the next slide, 59. This is pretty much a direct quote from this OSC in 5. "Why do you do prompt removal of the waste? Well, it rapidly decreases the risk." Makes sense to me. "Improves the appearance." Yep. "Uses your budget more evenly." Now, this is an issue where about 70% of your total budget will be expended when it comes time to do transportation and disposal. And so there's a big hump in the spending curve. And if you get rid of this stuff as quickly as you can, you spend your budget more evenly. It shows progress. Makes more room to work. Reduces the pilfering and temptation to enter the site inappropriately. This next one is you don't think about very often, but it improves the crew's morale and instills worker pride. The same thing is true with making sure that as you clean up, you don't leave candy wrappers and cigarette butts all around the break areas, that you take only pictures and leave only footprints. So if you wait till the end of the job, the conclusion from this particular OSC is, I don't think this is wise. It is possible. Some do it. Most don't. But prompt removal has advantages. Let's go to the next slide, which is 60. Tote. You see a tote in the background, and it's leaking. Well, there's a lesson in this. This came from a California site. Tote is a plastic container. It's made out of translucent plastic, and it's usually sized to match 4 or 5 drums. So they're about 200, 250 gallons, something like that. And they're commonly used. Let's go to, this is slide 61. Commonly used at many cleanups in place of drums. They're easily loaded with forklifts and so forth. The volume rating on these is pretty easy to tell because the plastic's translucent. You can see the fluid level inside there, and these are made generally for fluids. It could be for flowable powders too, but fluids. So you can look at the side of the container and see when you've reached the volume capacity or near it. The weight capacity is not so easy. You got to have some scales. This plastic is rated for a certain mass to support, and high-density plating solutions may exceed the capacity, the weight capacity of the tote, and as the OSC from California said, catastrophic failure with ugly results, self-inflicted emergency response action could have been avoided. Don't let that be you. Let's go to 62. All right, this is an interesting case right here. This is sampling at the Hitchcock site, the one that I referred to as a place to take your family for a picnic. This had a concrete block and concrete walls that various plating solutions had soaked into. And the question came up, we need to sample this wall, and we need to do it in such a way that we're able to tell whether we need to remove it or not. Well, you can hit it with a hammer and break some pieces out and send that to the lab. It's not very satisfactory. The OSC in this case, the guy been over here, is Chris Donofrio from Region 2. And Chris said, I got a great idea. I'm going to take a hammer drill, which you can purchase at the hardware store for $50 or so, and I'm going to put a masonry bit in it. And I'm going to drill a hole in the wall, and when I do, it will generate a sawdust. And as you see me there using the drill and using a manila folder, just a clean manila folder, to catch the dust that is a result of drilling the hole and pour that in a sample bag. Now, the laboratories absolutely love it because this is a already ground up material. You can get depth integration on this if you want to, by putting a ring of tape around the drill bit at an inch deep, and you get 0 to an inch deep sample. If you want a composite sample over a certain area, define the area with a tape square, then drill several holes in the tape square, and you get a composite result by mixing the resulting powder. So I thought that was real slick. Let's go to the next slide, which is 63. This is an interesting one, and I don't want anything I say here to be misconstrued as a criticism, but the upper line there is attempted to show the grid sampling approach that's been historically used on soil sites and soil sampling. And the bottom is an indication of a virtual sampling plan. Now, the virtual sampling plan does not use square pattern, as you see in the upper left diagram, but it results in the lines of equal concentration, I believe they're called isopleths, being generated. So you have an isopleth map like in the lower right-hand corner. And that's actually quite a bit more accurate as far as defining concentrations than the grid map. And this is a fairly new approach, and you've got a link there, vspn.pnl.gov, and that's a good one. And the message here is make sure you know what you're getting. In either one, you pick up the samples as you would in the upper right-hand picture where you put some dirt in the jar from a certain location. Let's go to the next slide, which is 64. The traditional soil removal is done with a track hoe or a backhoe, digging toward the cab, and away from the cab you've done your excavation. Close to the cab you've not done your excavation. And if you are faced with a translating a sample map onto the ground and then an earth crew to dig this up, what you will find is that it's very difficult or very challenging to transfer the virtual sampling result plans and the isopleths to the ground. Square patterns, on the other hand, are very easy to reproduce from the map. And you know, for example, grid square 12, we dig 6 inches. Grid square 19, we don't excavate at all. Grid square 23, we excavate a foot. And those are things the ERS crew is very accustomed to, and it works very well with the mechanical equipment. The virtual sampling plan is more difficult, considerably more difficult. In fact, in this case, it was very difficult for the state to not grasp this, but accept that it was doing as good a job as the grid pattern, and it resulted in a lot of extra confirmation samples being taken. And in the end, the OSC abandoned the virtual sampling plan at this particular site and went to the grid pattern, so there was extra work. The message is not that the virtual sampling plan is bad. The message is understand what you got, understand your process, make sure it's what you want. So be sure and talk to your contractors about that before you employ it. It is a great method, and it's probably more accurate than grids. All right, let's see. Let's go to the next slide. These are the OSC contributors. You probably see some names you know from a variety of regions. Region 10 is not represented here. 8 is not. But the rest of them are. And these were all interviewed, all but one, I believe, these were interviewed. So we want to thank these people for their patience and their contributions. And, Mike, I believe with that we have the opportunity for wrap-up and question and answers.
Great. Okay. Yeah, we have a few questions come in here.
Good.
We can go ahead and get started with. The first one is, have you seen contamination under competent concrete floors? In other words, can chemicals leach through the solid concrete, and do you need to sample under them?
I think that's a long-time argument, and the answer basically is, yes, it can reach under, it can penetrate through a slab. Some of the heavy metals, particularly mercury, passes through concrete like it was hardly even there. That's metallic mercury. You see that in the chloralkali business where they use concrete cells. And some of the other things that are acids that eat the concrete up make the concrete kind of go away. And that offers opportunity. There's three things concrete will do. It'll turn hard, it'll get gray, and it'll crack. So wherever there's a crack, there's a conduit for contamination to move through. And there's, I don't care what you do, unless you're taking the care to pour a nuclear power plant containment, you're going to have some hairline cracks at least, and maybe some worse than that. But, yes, it definitely moves under there. Now, there's another question, and that is, what's the cleanup objectives? You may find that contamination that's under a slab is probably kind of minimal, and because it is, you may decide to leave it. Now, the removal program has that option. The remedial program often does not. I hope that answers the question.
Okay. Okay, another one's about asbestos here. If asbestos-containing materials are present, at which point in the cleanup is it appropriate to remove it?
All right, now read that question again. I couldn't hear all of it.
It's about removing asbestos-containing materials. So the question is, if asbestos-containing materials are present, at what point in the cleanup process do you remove them?
I like to do that up front, and the reason is asbestos imposes some particular worker health and safety requirements, particularly respiratory protection, that are difficult to work with. It's not impossible to meet, just difficult. And friable asbestos, if you can get it out of there early, do so. That's my advice. But in the remedial program, that can be handled as an operable unit and done very nicely. In the removal program, it can be done as a separate removal action. There's no problem with doing multiple removal actions as long as the regional management is in support of that. Hope that answered the question.
Okay. Respirator masks have been shown in several of the pictures, including the hammer drill sampling. Beyond the dust, what other respirator cartridge is used there?
Okay, I'm not a health and safety expert and don't claim to be. Everything about particulates, though, is about size. And many of the typical general organic vapor canisters are preceded by a HEPA filter, and it gets all the particulates that you need to out. There is a health and safety expert in every region, and I would suggest that you propose that question to them. Obviously, air purifying respirators require cartridges, and there's a decision to be made. If you upgrade to supplied air, no cartridge selection has to be specified, but you have all the downside of the upgrade in safety, the additional weight, the additional burden, the additional heat stress, and so forth. Hope that answers the question.
don't have any more that have come in so far through the chat field here. So are there any questions for those participating on the phone that have not typed any questions in yet? Or anybody on the phone, for that matter.
Remember, you have to unmute.
Yeah, you have to unmute, so that'll be #6 if you use
#6. Question in regards to the wastewater. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you have any sort of general, I guess I'm picturing sort of a rule of thumb maybe as to how much wastewater is generally associated with the pretreatment as compared to the wastewater from the rinsing in the plating side?
I'm not sure I understand your question. You're talking about in the process itself, right?
Yeah, I think what I'm thinking is, you know, in terms of water being discharged from a plating site, plating operation, like gallons per day, how much of that might be the rinsing and how much might be related to the plating?
It's almost all related to the rinsing, but, you know, what you get in the rinse is...
I'm sorry, I'm thinking the cleaning rinse, I guess, before plating.
Oh, I see. I think it depends a little bit on the specific nature of the specific process. For example, if you're doing automobile bumpers and you're doing chrome, automobile bumpers are made out of steel. Many times they'll copper plate them and then chrome plate over the copper, and it just makes a superior coating. It hangs in there with you. Longevity is better. Most of the issue is cleaning the oil and grease off of the part, and it would go like this. Hot alkaline cleaner followed by 2 or 3 rinse baths and then into the plating solution. Well, 2 or 3 rinse baths, then an acid bath, and the acid is to get the last of the scale off of there, the rust oxide, and then 2 or 3 rinse baths, and then into the plating solution, then 2 or 3 rinse baths, and then if there's going to be any color change, like a chrome anodizing that changes from dark color to, or from one color to another, copper-looking color or brass-looking color, then 2 or 3 rinses. So my sense of it is, I actually worked in the plating industry for a short period of time during my college years, and most of the time my recollection was the vast majority of the wastewater is generated after the cleaning step. I hope that answers the question.
Yep, thank you. Makes sense.
Is there anybody else on the phone that has a question?
This has been a good group of participants. You guys have asked great questions and insightful.
And based on comments that I've gotten regarding the purple material that was underneath the concrete, if it is permanganate, there are numerous amounts of plausible reasons why it might be there that have come in. So,
I agree. That's one of the reasons it's entirely important. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice.
Are there any more questions from the phone lines? I have not received any new questions coming in during the case study period. In about, I would assume that most of you have gotten your questions in. If you take a moment and bear with me, the last two slides, slide 66, we have provided a resources and feedback. The question quick way to get back to the seminar page and get to the additional resources. Also a link to the feedback form. We appreciate your feedback. You fill that out. You can print out after you fill it out, you can print out the page that follows as a receipt of your attendance. Not everybody needs to do that, but some people like to have something that says, hey, you at least signed up and made it through to the feedback. Slide 67 shows us some of the new social media ways that you can stay connected with Clue-In. And some of, every time that we provide a bunch of announcements and when we post new things, when there's new seminars and that type of thing, when seminars are posted. And with that, if there are no other questions, we'll end today's seminar. Well, thanks to Jim for providing us with an informative seminar. And look for the archive in about 2 weeks. Thank you for attending.